I'm Mindy Todd. Welcome to The Point. Chances are you have gambled at least once in your lifetime. 4 in 5 Americans say they have. With the exception of Hawaii and Utah, every state in the country offers some form of legalized gambling. You don't even have to leave the house. All you need is an internet connection and a phone. So when does gambling become an addiction? Joining us to talk about the psychology of gambling is psychologist Michael Abbruzzese. Good morning.
Good morning.
Psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz. Good morning to you.
Hello.
And psychiatrist Mark Whaley. Good morning.
Good morning, Mindy.
All right, so gambling can be an addiction, according to researchers, and this is relatively new. The psychiatric community used to consider pathological gambling as a compulsion rather than an addiction. So what changed?
Well, what it changed is a broader understanding of it. Compulsion means that a person is compelled to do something, like people that have obsessive compulsive disorder are compelled to wash their hands. They're compelled not to touch something that they think might be have germs on it, or clean the house, et cetera. And so the treatment that's effective there, medication plays some role, but the treatment that really has some benefit that has been shown is cognitive behavioral therapy, a psychotherapy, basically, which also changes the way the brain functions, I might add, like the medicines do. But at any rate, that was the approach toward gambling. It wasn't really looked at or thought of as a true addiction. Now, with the scanning techniques that we have and genetic studies that we have, it's been shown that gambling and drug addiction are very similar in terms of the effects on the brain, in terms of the areas that get stimulated, the areas that get destimulated, if you will, underactive. And they're really the same in both conditions. People can have withdrawal symptoms if they're truly addicted to gambling. Not everybody, you know, who does gamble gets this. Probably less than 2% of the population get to the what's called the pathological or disordered type of gambling. And that's defined by how central gambling is to the person's life. They just focus on it, just like a drug addict focuses on getting the heroin that they need.
Does this surprise anybody?
Well, no. I mean, I think psychologists know this for a long time. We tend to bunch a lot of treatment options for conditions similarly, especially when it comes to behavioral and cognitive stuff. I would just add to what Mark said in that I think the hallmark of an addiction, any addiction, is that the individual seems to have a primary relationship with the item, object, or behavior versus another person. You know, so they're addicted to their substance. They're addicted to their behavior, their gambling or something like that, or their repetitive self-abuse kind of things. So it's really a relationship issue on a psychological basis. On a behavioral basis, it's more like the ABCs of how you change behavior. But they're very powerful reinforcers that takes a long time to break.
It's a fatal love attraction, basically. Mm-hmm. Fatal attraction disordered love.
I had pulled out of the research you sent, Mark. This research has led to a new understanding of addiction in general. Experts used to think of addiction as dependency on a chemical. They now define it as repeatedly pursuing a rewarding experience despite serious repercussions. So it's kind of what you just mentioned. And you mentioned something else that's important. It's not everyone who gambles can become addicted to gambling, and that's like true of, you know, alcohol or drugs or anything else. There are some people who can drink moderately and not have a problem, and others who cannot. So
Genetics play a role here, most definitely. And there's some theories about it, you know, that have some evidence about how genetics play a role, but they do play a role. And people with family histories should be a little bit more cautious than people without family histories of gambling or alcohol, drug problems.
Yeah, I want to add to that the what we call in my field the behavioral inheritance, you know, or a predestination, a predilection to getting what seems to be a genetic influence. And it's really just somehow we can't really explain it, but you can metaphorically seem to inherit someone's behavior even without a gene, whether that's genetic expression or simply because you've been exposed to it ever since, you know, you were a newborn, is something. So even if you don't have a frank genetic connection, the additional power is the fact that there can be a behavioral inheritance because of simply your observation and reinforcement that happens to be below your level of conscious awareness. And so most of our behaviors are learned what we call serendipitously or accidentally, but they're very powerfully attached to us. And unless we become aware of that, as Mark and I talked about before, awareness has to be the first step to being able to change any kind of behavior. So if you don't think, oh, I'm not addicted or I'm not a problem drinker or a gambler, then that you can't use that. You have to use a third-party observer, independent third-party observer to evaluate the behavior.
I think also related to that, you know, in the literature about gambling, it often you see comments about associated other disorders which are associated. Mm. And I think we see that often with all kinds of addictions. I see it in my own practice treating opiate addiction, that a majority of people who come to me for treatment of opiate addiction have an underlying, undiagnosed, pre-existing either mood or anxiety disorder, and most often it's actually an anxiety disorder, specifically social anxiety. Mm. And people who have gambling problems, I think if you or a member of your family, a friend has a problem with gambling, it pays to ask yourself if there's something else going on which in a way fuels the pleasure that comes with the distraction. Mm-hmm. Because gambling is very much something which occupies larger and larger amounts of real estate inside your head, mm-hmm. In a way that pushes out all so many other things.
Yeah, that's right.
I'm wondering, do you sometimes find if somebody has, you know, is say addicted to alcohol, and then they, you know, go to get into recovery and they're sober, and maybe they change that addiction to something else, like gambling or anything else. I mean, if you have kind of an addictive personality, is that something you have to be aware of, that you might try to replace one addiction with another?
Yeah, I think the coping hypothesis is a good metaphor. People are trying to reduce their anxiety, treat their own depression, and we know that with people who use substances. They try to self-medicate. You can self-medicate by having behavior. There's a sexual addiction, there's a gambling addiction, there's obsessive behavior, and any kind of thing. You can attach an obsession to any kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And it's important to understand that sometimes people are just rearranging chairs on the Titanic when they go from one addictive item to another. But it's important to understand that those things can all be treated, and it does take a lot of multiple interventions. People who work with alcohol and drug addicts know that sometimes quite often, the first inpatient detox just doesn't take. Mm-hmm. And some people, you go 12, 14, 16, 18, 20 times. And, mm-hmm. and the question for a lot of parents is, when do I stop? When do we give up on this?
Right. Yeah.
You never know when it's going to take.
But also, if you have an addictive personality, I'm thinking of somebody I know who, she says, you know, she knows that about herself. So what she focused on was exercise. The gym. She said, all right, so I've got this addictive personality. I want to do something that's going to be positive for me.
She
kind of is obsessive about her workouts and things, but she's taken it and kind of flipped it around the other way.
Yeah, that's great. Yeah. That works. The other big avenue toward addiction in general and also gambling addiction is ADHD, attention deficit disorder, because those people are very frequently very impulsive and risk-seeking. To kind of get themselves feeling alive and focused. Something that's risky challenges them and focuses their mind, whereas without it, they drift around and are scattered. Mm-hmm. And that's disturbing to them. You know, it's a dysphoric or it's an uncomfortable feeling.
And I can tell you, as somebody who has ADHD and who's been taking drugs for it for over 30 years, that the one time I was in Las Vegas, which was 5 days for a medical conference, I did not gamble a single quarter because I knew that first quarter was going to just end up with me going home broke.
Yeah,
right. And I have an addictive personality, and I have to be, you know, and that's one addiction. I mean, to walk out of a casino after giving up hundreds or thousands of dollars. I mean, I would just, I just couldn't even talk. I wouldn't be able to bear that. You know,
how do you go home?
I think there's always. Part of that, I think it's really multi-determinants. We talk about gambling, we talk about all addictions as though it's a unitary source disorder, and it's not. These things are all multi-determinant, and you could have, it's probably fair to talk about a spectrum, you know, an addictive spectrum, as opposed to, like, it's not like an old Route 6A highway that you go down. It's a lot of ways to get there. And one of the things is a cultural phenomenon by European gamblers, James Bond and other suave people, going back to Cary Grant and Clark Gable. You can bet a lot and they can just walk away from it, you know, and you don't think. And there's this cachet about being cool and sophisticated, being able to do that. But the reality is not that. The reality is really much more, much closer to the gutter than being in a tuxedo walking away from your winnings.
Yeah. Right.
Although that's an interesting, it reminds me
oh,
the first time.
Now Mark is going to reveal.
What's that?
Now, Mark is going to reveal his own episode in the tuxedo being.
Well, actually, the first time I ever was in a casino was in South America in Caracas, Venezuela on a vacation in the 70s, early 70s. And one thing I noticed was all these South American people dressed to the hilt. They looked beautiful. They were young, in their 20s, and they were gambling big chips, and they had almost no expression of emotion. They were like flat schizophrenics almost, the way they were doing it. It was clear that they were on display for everybody else and each other. That was the... I think the psychology behind it.
You mean they were like props almost for the casino?
Almost, yeah, almost. Yeah, they could have been.
Yeah, could have been.
But they weren't. They'd win, and okay. They just
interesting.
Winning means you just pull the chips to you,
right.
And that was it. And then they go on to the next hand.
So
I was
adding,
really struck by that.
You're adding a cultural aspect to the addictive quality?
No. I'm adding, well, I don't know. I haven't cross-cultured research, but I've seen that in U.S. casinos, too.
Oh, also, they have a flat expression.
Yeah, some people. Others, are like Red Sox fans at World Series.
But. I was thinking my first experience was Las Vegas, but you guys reminded me that when I lived in New York in the late 70s, we used to go to these after-hours clubs and play blackjack, which was totally illegal at the time. But I always had it was $20. $20 is not what it used to be, right?
Yeah.
And I would, as soon as I won my $20 back, I'd put it back in my pocket.
Yeah.
But we did get raided once, and they took our names and told us to go home. But my first Vegas experience, though, I thought I was going to like the slot machines. I didn't understand them, those little papers. But roulette, I didn't like the blackjack was too much pressure because the people around, if you don't play your hand just right, they get mad. So, but I thought the roulette wheel was really a lot of fun. And so when I got back, I'm like, yeah, let's go to, I don't know if it was Foxwoods or Mohegan Sun. Literally, we lasted not even 20 minutes in there. It was so depressing. Las Vegas is a little different because you got a mix of, tourists and locals and things like that. But I don't know. I find them, I find casinos a little bit depressing. You see these people who clearly don't have the money to be doing what they're doing. And and it's sad.
Yeah. The approach also that the government or that the, that the states take to gambling is also a really interesting cultural aspect of this because there's a conflict of interest, isn't there?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the state governments make huge amounts of money, not only from the lottery tickets that they sell in every convenience store, but also from the revenues that they get from all the casinos, which are licensed, whether they're, Native American casinos or other casinos. And so even though there does seem to be some attention paid to letting people know that there's help for problem gambling.
Mm-hmm.
There's also, I don't know. It's fascinating to me, where the balance is struck between really encouraging people to get help or even in some cases, casinos asking people to leave when they can see that they're really, in over their heads. And yet, they're in it to make money. The states are in it to make money.
Sure.
House always wins.
That's right.
House always wins. Yeah.
Well, that's like the sponsorship of drinking. Drinking is legal. Alcohol is legal, even though we know it destroys lives. And the state gets their money. They try and monitor the alcohol license and then get money out of that. But for a long time, they refused to regulate any kind of drugs. And that's changed now with the marijuana legislation. But there are a lot of people who thought for many decades that if the state regulated all drugs, even major drugs, cocaine and other things like that, there would be not as much of a problem with overdoses or people having difficulty with drug addiction because the state would have more control over it and try and manage it. That's why they try and manage liquor and alcohol. Mm-hmm. But there's always been that hypocritical kind of aspect of the so-called state taking care of people like that. Mm.
One of the most successful and seductive advertising slogans I have ever seen in my life is one that the Mass Lottery used to use. If I think it was the Mass Lottery, it said, if you don't play, you can't win.
Yeah, right.
That's right.
I mean, how brief is that? And how beautiful. Of course, they also don't say, if you don't play, you can't lose.
Right. It's true. And, you know, and certainly if you play like a certain number all the time, that would be, to me, would be dangerous. Because then you don't play and your number wins. You go, I should have played. But, I think that dollar, when the jackpot's really high, that dollar to kind of daydream about what you're going to do with all that money that you were probably never going to win,
sure,
is worth it. It's worth the dollar for the daydream. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
Pay a dollar and you get some pleasure out of the daydream.
Exactly. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626 if you'd like to chime in. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll talk more after a quick break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of gambling with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese and psychiatrists Jonathan Schwartz and Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626, our email address, thepoint@capeandislands.org. So we have this idea that the gambler is just is looking for that big payout. That's really not always that way, right? MIT researcher found machine gamblers in particular want to keep playing to get into this zone where nothing else matters, losing track of time and space. It's not. Sometimes they get annoyed when they win.
That's right. Yeah, because it breaks that zone. Mm-hmm. That's what they're seeking is escape, and it's that in itself is addictive. That's what this researcher found by interviewing a number of people that sat at the slot machines. And I think if you walk through a casino through the slot machine section, which is usually the first thing you walk into, mm-hmm. You will see some people are like in a daze, just sitting there pushing the number, pushing the buttons. They don't even have to crank mm-hmm. a handle anymore. It's that easy. It's just the button push.
Yeah, and I think that and a good of course term waiting think, like don't sit in that machine next to them because they're playing two at a time.
Yeah, and then doing that too. Right. Yeah, right.
Well, the notion is that if you've just won, if you've just gotten a payout, then you're in sort of a valley because you presume that it's now going to be quite a while before the next possible payout.
That's right.
So the anticipation and the adrenaline, is blocked in a way by that very recent
payout,
jackpot.
Yeah.
I just want to introduce a word that talked about being in the zone. It's really a sense of being entranced, almost like a hypnotic trance that you're in. You're sort of fixated on something. And we do this to ourselves all the time. A good common example would be highway hypnosis. You know, people are driving mm-hmm. on a highway, and they're pretty much on automatic pilot, unless there's some anomaly that happens. They really don't pay conscious attention to what's going on. So you can be entranced by anything, and that's why when you go to a lot of casinos, when was the last time anyone has been to a casino and there were like windows and sunshine mm-hmm. outside?
Oh, no,
there's no windows in those things. It's all dark. It's like totally controlled environment trying to keep you entranced.
They say they don't pump in oxygen, but I don't believe it.
So keep in mind that the whole goal is to entrance you, to keep you being like a robotic. And I will just talk about the behavior reinforcement, the most powerful reinforcement paradigm is something called intermittent reinforcement paradigm, which means that you don't do something consistently. It is the inconsistent reinforcement schedule that is the most powerful to reinforce a behavior and the most difficult to break. A lot of people think, I'm not consistent enough, I'm not 100%. That's nothing. That's nothing compared to the inconsistent, which is why most people fall into bad behavior because they've been inconsistently reinforced. They don't realize how it's taken over their lives. Because they can't pinpoint it. I don't do this every day. This doesn't happen all the time. It doesn't have to happen all the time. Mm-hmm. A couple of times is enough.
And you know that inconsistent reinforcement applies in many areas which have nothing to do necessarily with pathology.
Right.
So I noticed, for example, being a fisherman, that if you go out fishing and you don't catch any fish. I mean, yes, it is true, the cliche, a bad day of fishing is, I suppose, better than a good day at the office. But if you don't catch fish, time and time again, it gets discouraging.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I've been lucky enough on occasion to go out fishing, whether freshwater or saltwater, and the fish are like practically jumping into the boat. But, that's not so much fun either after the first few times the fish jumps in the boat. It's sort of, you don't feel like you've earned anything, My great-grandfather was a tin manufacturer, and I used to be in the antique business, and I would travel all over the place to yard sales and so on looking for this Hilson tinware. And eBay destroyed that for me because all I have to do is go on, you know, go online and type in Hilson Tin. You know, like that's
hunt.
No
enjoyment
that,
of going
it's either there or it isn't. But
you
there's
like
no
the
hunt.
Yeah.
Hunt. There's
yeah.
no hunt.
Yeah.
So that intermittent, you know, that intermittent reinforcement is satisfying and necessary in so many types of search.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
That's another aspect, I think, to the zone that makes that, you know, trance-like zone that people talk about that makes gambling rather unique, and because the added ingredient to being in the zone, it's not like, well, maybe we should just have these people meditate, and mm-hmm. That would be nice, get the same benefit without costing them so much. But they're in a zone in which they're anticipating a shot of dopamine or a shot of pleasure. And even if they don't show it, it's still on an anticipatory mechanism. So that's what kind of keeps them in the chair there.
I wonder if those the example of, that you gave us of folks in South America having a very flat affect in this. I wonder if they're actually getting that. They're getting that.
Oh, I think they are. But it's stylish not to show it. I think maybe that's one of the things. At least for that population.
Yeah. Right.
But I also think, and from what I've read in the research, there is a deadening of pleasure experience and with addictions,
mm-hmm.
Just like the drug addict can't get a high anymore.
More and more.
Right.
You got to
take
more
and more. Oversaturated.
Yeah.
Yes,
right.
And it's a biological mechanism for that. The dopamine receptors get less sensitive, right. And less dopamine's produced on a biological basis because of the experience of intense dopamine release that came from the drug.
So we know from our research. So what happens when the rat does not get the food when they press the bar? Well, the rat does not say, okay, I guess I'll go. The rat keeps on pressing the bar more and more. So we're not paying attention to those behavioral cues or those, you know, neurological cues. We don't respond to them the way we normally do.
Right. And that speaks to an imbalance between reward-driven behavior on a biological basis versus logical behavior, which is another part of the brain. That part of the brain has been shown, it's the frontal lobe again.
The executive functioning area.
That part of the brain has been shown to be also underactive in pathological gamblers and underactive in drug addicts.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Let's talk to Jim, who's giving us a call from Providence. Hi, Jim.
Hey, Jim.
Oh, hi. Good morning. Thank you guys for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, what does a person do when they feel that trigger in their life and they know that the response is going to be the wrong one? How do you change that behavior?
It's a good question.
Well, the first step is just what you just said, knowing that it's there. And if you can insert some time between knowing and acting, that would be the second step, I think. At least put some time in between there and consider pros and cons, et cetera, and then go from there. You know, humans are blessed. We're the dominant species on Earth because we're blessed with the ability to model the future, look into the future. And that's what I think has made us dominant. So what you want to do is look into the future of acting or not acting, and judge your decision based on that.
Well, Jim, can I ask you, if it's not too personal, how does this seem to manifest itself in an example you can give us from your own experience?
Oh, well, I mean, I don't have an addiction per se, but I do find that when I've had a stressful day, I'm always like, when I go home, I'll say, I should have an apple, but I think I'm going to have a couple of cookies. I deserve it.
I see. Yeah.
You know, and I'm like, and then after I eat the cookies, I'm like, why didn't I eat the apple? Why did I just do that? Even though,
if a couple of cookies is the worst it gets, you're a lucky man.
Yeah,
that's right.
Yeah. I don't eat the whole bag, but I just know that it's the wrong thing. And I'm saying, how can I control this? But it's that whole feeling that I deserve a cookie. I had a stressful day.
Right.
Why can't I have that cookie?
Yeah.
How do you control that? How do you?
I think that's
that
that's a simple behavioral kind of response. Your body's been conditioned on multiple levels to get that kind of boost that you get from the cookie. So there's a little bit of sugar boost or chocolate boost, but there's also a psychological boost because, you know, cookies and milk, any kind of sweet kind of craving has always been seen by our culture, at least here in America, of being a reward-based behavior. So we have a hard day, we reward ourselves with, like Jonathan said, a cookie, and if you're lucky if that's all it is. But people who have been in AA and people who are alcoholics for years, they know that every excuse is a good excuse to drink, but no excuse is a good excuse to drink. And they've learned that kind of behavior. So they have a different kind of behavioral response pattern than most of us do when we have a hard day. You know, we have maybe a cookie or ice cream or something like that. I think that you have simply not had enough opportunities to change your reinforcement schedule, is the jargon that I would use in my treatment, so that every time you have a particular kind of day, you would break that association with coming home for a cookie, and you would have that association for grapes or strawberries or something else like that. There's also the preparation factor. If you want to come home and have strawberries, unless you prepare those suckers ahead of time, it takes a long time to do that. Where a cookie, just grab and go.
Yeah, after a hard day, you want a reward, and you deserve a reward. You're absolutely right that you deserve it, but you have a choice about what reward you take.
Yeah, and Jim, I would say I hear you because, you know, I love those double stuffed Oreos too. But you know what I do? I don't buy them. I mean, once in a while, I go and like they call me in the grocery store. They're like, "Hello, I'm over here."
So that's
but
like
I try
what Jonathan said. He didn't even go into the casino because he knew he would be gambling. You don't even go down that aisle. That's both a very good example of like you avoid that stuff. You don't set yourself up for it.
But I think also on a practical level, now having known through your history that there's a step-by-step process that takes place. You have a hard day. You're driving home. You get home. You think about rewarding yourself. And what comes most naturally is the cookies. So having now understood that, you can plan on your drive home for a different kind of reward, which you have, you know, provided for, whether it be an apple or strawberries. Maybe an apple isn't really enough of a reward to, you know, attract you. And you might want to think about, well, what would be a different reward for a stressful day that you would also feel good about having?
A chocolate-covered strawberry.
That's good. Right?
You're a big help.
Now, the anticipation of a reward that you've already learned is rewarding is rewarding. By thinking about it, you're already priming yourself and making it harder to resist the behavior.
Well, let me just focus on that for a second. That's a really powerful thing. There are many people who work in restaurants have this experience in the fact that they no longer are attracted to the wonderful food that they make. They will tell you, this, the smell of the food fills me up. I don't have to eat it anymore. Mm-hmm. So there is a point that you can condition yourself to get to the point of, I anticipate the reward, and then you no longer need the actual manifestation of the reward because you've already filled up yourself psychologically with it.
Although I can say I had that experience when I was a teenager. I worked at an ice cream shop. And, you know, all that sticky ice cream all the way up to your shoulder. I couldn't eat ice cream for years after that. It was just like brought back the memories of all that sticky shoulder stuff.
Sure.
All right. Jim, thanks for the call. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. And we were talking about, you know, how this impacts different parts of the brain. And researchers noticed a high number of Parkinson's patients are compulsive gamblers. So why is this a significant finding?
That's interesting. It's not the disease itself that raises the risk for gambling, because the disease itself is from a lack of dopamine. Certain cells in the middle part of the brain, old brain, die off. And those cells are dopamine-producing cells, and they have a lot to do with motor coordination and a lot of other things in the brain, all of which deteriorate as Parkinson's disease progresses. So the treatment for Parkinson's disease, as we saw in the movie The Awakening, is a drug that increases dopamine. And there's several medications that do that. L-DOPA is the common one. By increasing dopamine, you can actually lessen inhibitions and increase impulsivity, because that's what dopamine does. And in a certain percentage of Parkinson's patients, maybe about 5 or 6%, it's not that frequent, they can start gambling or make rash decisions, rash business decisions, or be a little bit more irritable. And it's only because of they're particularly sensitive to the increase in dopamine that is also helping their condition. So it's one of those.
That's a tricky thing. Maybe you've known your whole life, you haven't had, and all of a sudden now you're compulsive gambler.
Yeah.
I wonder if that's something that neurologists ever warn patients about when they're prescribing
it. Good question.
I've never heard of it.
But. Yeah, no, I think once in a while, and I've seen it with a patient or two it's happened.
So we were talking about kind of getting into this zone, and I was thinking, and a lot of times this gambling is also similar to gaming. We've talked about gaming before. And people spend hours and hours and, sometimes not even get up to eat or go to the bathroom, just, so focused on, 24 hours.
That's a zone.
Yeah. And
it's the same kind of thing. We know there's a gaming addiction or internet addiction or screen addiction. Anyone who has a teenage child, even a preteen child, stuck to the computer screen or their cell phone, the Android or iPhone, whatever it is. So there's a lot of addiction out there because we are, Mark's going to have taught this before, that what people tend to be routinized in their behavior. Our brain is hardwired to keep on doing things that we do. We fall into these behavior patterns. And only the anomaly attracts our attention if there's something odd going on. There's also something very self-soothing about some of the colors that attract our attention. If you have a certain kind of screensaver, something like that, it's something very soothing. And anything that goes in through our eyes is usually very powerful in grabbing our attention. So it's easy for someone to become addicted to any kind of screen. And pretty much all of us have screens. We have computers, we have laptops, we have iPads, something like that. So it's a very big problem for people. And the measure I use about whether a student or a child might be addicted to the screen or an adult is if you tell them to put it down and walk away, if they can do that without any kind of difficulty. If they can do that, then fine. But if they can't do that, if they give you some kind of protest, that probably they have some kind of addictive quality going on that ought to be treated, because that could only get worse. It's not going to get better on its own. It can be just as powerful as any kind of other addiction that we talked about so far today.
Yeah. We're talking about the psychology of gambling. 866-999-4626 is our number. That's 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. We'll have more after a break. You're listening to The Point. We are talking about the psychology of gambling with psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Whaley. 866-999-4626 is our number if you'd like to join the conversation. 866-999-4626. Our email address is thepoint@capeandislands.org. So a lot of times when we talk about addiction, we talk about, triggers or cues, and same goes here, right? I mean, even years later, there are things that can... Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And it's been shown again that the brain changes in response to triggers and cues. And I'm talking about drug addicts, alcoholics, and gamblers. The same parts of the brain change their action level. Important part would be, again, part of the frontal cortex having to do with planning. That kind of gets juiced up as opposed to the part of, that has to do with depressing or suppressing impulses. But also there's another part of the brain, deep in the brain, that's part of the outer layer, but it's just buried in the brain. It's called the insula, I-N-S-U-L-A. It's part of the cortex. And that is a very interesting part in that it is so well connected with so many other areas of the brain. And it kind of coordinates motivation, coordinates how the body feels. It's been shown that exposure to cues to people who are gamblers or drug addicts, the insula gets more active. So that means your whole feeling state changes through that part of the brain. So you really are, the cues do, it's not only a psychological reminder, it has a biological effect. And your body can change once you've been addicted, I'm talking about. Addictions do change the brain, and that's why people in AA say, I can't drink the successful people, I can never drink, or I can never go in a bar. I can never smell it again. Don't let me near it. That's because they're guarding against that bodily experience that results from what the substance, the overuses of the substance, did to their brain.
Mm-hmm. Now, is treatment for gambling addiction similar then to other addictions? I mean, we're talking about, you know, drug addiction being similar, you know, circuitry in the brain. So is treatment similar?
Yeah, that's the other big advance, I think, in treatment, that there are treatments that are successful for addiction are in addition to the psychological ones that we've always worked on, like AA and the 12-step programs. Because the opiate system is involved in addiction, we have in our brains what we call endogenous opiate receptors. In other words, our brain does have receptors that respond to drugs that are or to substances that are classified as opiates. And that's the chemical messenger of pleasure and reward. There is a drug that's called an opiate blocker. The drug is naltrexone, N-A-L-T-R-E-X-O-N-E, which has been around since the 60s or so. It's the drug that is used to rescue people who have an opiate overdose. Because what happens is if they have an opiate overdose and their breathing is going to get depressed and they'll die, if they're gotten to by a responder quick enough with an injection or an inhalation of naltrexone, the molecules of naltrexone will knock off the excessive heroin on these receptors and sit on the receptor itself, just like a lock, like a cap. Yes, exactly. And so the heroin can't get back on the receptor. The person will wake up, usually within a short time. So that's what an opiate blocker does. Well, if you give naltrexone in a daily dose of, usually it's 50 milligrams a day, if you do that, then you are essentially blocking your opiate receptors without harm in general to any other functioning. But they're blocked to the point where if you take a shot of heroin, say, you won't get high. And the big advantage is you won't have cravings as much, or some people, if at all, because that opiate system is no longer operative, say, when exposed to a cue. So it's been proven that the use of naltrexone can be used in all sorts of addictive behaviors, certainly in opiate addiction. There is a form of it that's given on a once-a-month basis by an injection. Certainly in that, and in gambling too. Less so, but still useful sometimes in food addictions, that naltrexone can be used through this mechanism that I just described. So that's why you hear with the opiate crisis that we need medication-assisted treatment availability. That doesn't mean it's the whole thing. But naltrexone will be a part of that medication assistance.
So the injection that police officers give is really the Narcan.
That's right.
But that's not much of a treatment. That'll save someone's life.
No,
it's not really a treatment. We need better facilities, I think, for treatment on that.
Oh, sure.
It's also interesting to note, you've heard me bang the drum for magnetic stimulation therapy for depression here on the show. There's some wonderful, really compelling research being done on the treatment of addictions with this same transcranial magnetic stimulation. And I've watched videos of people being treated both for cocaine addiction and nicotine addiction. And what's really interesting is so that in the research, there's three groups. There's a placebo group. There's a group that receives the magnetic stimulation in the sort of usual way. And then there's what we call the provoked group. So, for example, somebody who's a cigarette smoker will sit in the chair and you give them a cigarette and they smell the cigarette and put it on their lips. So that's a provocation, like they're getting ready to light up.
Yeah.
They're going to light up both neurologically and literally. The group that's treated with the TMS immediately after this provocation has an even higher batting average of remission than the group of cigarette smokers who are not provoked immediately right. before their treatment. Mm-hmm. And this has also been done in a pilot study with cocaine addiction. Hmm. So we're talking only about maybe 50 subjects at most, right. not enough for, FDA approval. But I think that's the future also,
yeah.
because
yeah.
there you have a safe treatment. Now, yeah. I don't know anything about even a pilot study for gambling,
yeah.
but why the heck wouldn't it be just as applicable?
Reasonable to try, because yeah. what you want to do is you want to influence the brain in some way, and specifically the insula part of the brain that I mentioned before. It has been shown or has been known that people who, for some neurological reason, have damage to their insula, and if they're a smoker, they've been a smoker all the time, a lot of them quit for no particular reason mm-hmm. other than they don't have that neurological
urge.
Neurological driver to keep smoking.
Well, we talked earlier about anxiety playing a role in all this, and I'm just thinking we had done a program a while back about them using acupuncture in treating this was opioid abuse, I believe. And it was not so much that what it did was treat the anxiety. The patient that was in here talking about it said that she really felt, that it was addressing her anxiety. It was making her more relaxed, which was helping her not have the cravings. Mm. So there's probably a whole lot of area of stuff here that we're just beginning to understand that could be used in treatments
sure.
going forward.
Right.
We have a note from Mike in Woods Hole who says, I've always said I don't understand addiction, but I'm not sure if I get why that is. Is it biological or strictly psychological? I've never smoked or placed a bet. I've never even tried drugs, not even pot. I have a couple of beers and not have another for 3 weeks without a problem. It's hard for me to relate to gambling or other addictions. I honestly wish I understood more. I have friends with addictions.
Sure.
Well, it's multi-determined. It's not one or the other, but each one is reinforcing. So behavior reinforces electrical, the neurochemical changes in our brain, and neurochemical electrical changes in our brain and neurology affect our behavior. So it's reciprocal
both.
And multi-determinant.
The simple answer to his question is it's both. It's both yeah. psychological and biological.
Right. Mm-hmm.
That's why the treatments that we're coming mm-hmm. to nowadays are both.
Yeah. And it's, I think, hard for some people. They go, why would they do that? Why would you gamble away all of your money when you know you have mortgage?
Sure, but it's also hard for a lot of people to understand a lot of things.
Right.
People have gender disparities. Mm-hmm. They don't understand why another person would think the way they do. People have, we talked about on this program, racial issues, conspiracy mm-hmm. theorists. A lot of times people have difficulty wrapping their mind around yeah. a different kind of experience that they
right.
have. That's part of the human experience, to have difficulty understanding someone else's experience. As some people are better at it than others. So mm-hmm. it's very common. There's a lot of misunderstanding in other people's motivations and their behavior. And we ask ourselves, why? I wonder why that is. But I think that's a big mistake. We've trained people in this country to always want to know why, as though that's the magic answer. It's not. The magic question to ask is how mm-hmm. do you overcome something?
Mm-hmm.
And that's what you need to learn. So if you know that, why am I doing this? That's because I'm an alcoholic. Okay, that pretty much ends the conversation. That doesn't tell you how you overcome mm-hmm. that.
Right.
Right. So knowing why is not the whole story.
And I think the irony is that many of us who are mental health professionals become mental health professionals because we are primarily fascinated with the question of why.
Mm-hmm.
At least speaking for myself, that's certainly.
Sure.
I'm much more interested in why people do things than I am in what they do.
Mm-hmm.
And yet here we are in our work, it ultimately – it's not always about why. It's just about, okay, so what can we do about it?
Yeah,
right.
Sure.
How do we
sure,
move
sure.
forward?
Before we leave the medication-assisted business, I found there's a lot of misunderstanding with Suboxone out there. Maybe, Jonathan, you have some direct experience with it. Can you tell us about the role of Suboxone in medication-assisted substance
sure.
abuse treatment?
Sure. No, I'm not sure if there's some specific misunderstandings that you're referring to, but
they think it's an opiate, and you're just giving them legal opiate.
Well, actually, that is true. It is
right.
an opiate, buprenorphine, which is the generic name for the active ingredient. It is an opiate. What makes Suboxone for many people, a miraculous treatment is that there isn't a high that's associated with the use of Suboxone. So there isn't that reinforcement that comes from other opiates like heroin and Percocet and so on. And it's a drug that you can take in the same way that you would take a drug for hypertension, mm-hmm. Once a day or twice a day, depending on your schedule, and get on with your life, and have your insurance, pay for this medicine while you are tackling and addressing all the other aspects of your history of addiction, so that for most people, not for all, but for most people, there's eventually a tapering off of the Suboxone. This is an area of some controversy. When I first started prescribing Suboxone, the federal agency that's kind of sponsors the whole thing and trains docs in how to do it. And by the way, nurse practitioners are now eligible to become Suboxone prescribers, which is quite a new phenomenon in Massachusetts. But when I first started, it was clearly stated that the goal not only was to taper people off Suboxone, but to taper them off in a pretty short period of time. A lot of physicians would taper somebody over 30 days, 60 days, or at most 90 days. But I think that there are many of us now who believe that for some people, remaining on Suboxone long term is a much more satisfactory solution.
Right. Yeah. It's not only there's no high associated, correct, but there's also no sickness associated.
I wanted to mention, we talked about every state having, except for Utah and Hawaii, having some form of legalized gambling. Gambling pretty well accepted. So a lot of people who might have gambling issues don't seek treatment. I think it was a statistic, 80% of gambling addicts never seek treatment. And I guess, too, sometimes recognizing that, we talked about recognizing the problem being important. And it was making me think of the superstitious behaviors. We blow on the dice thinking we've got some kind of control when really we don't, right? And so what's the thought on if you have somebody in your life who you think has a gambling addiction, I would think that might be a tough one to tackle.
Very tough.
Yeah,
very tough.
It is. Actually, when you look at the members of Gamblers Anonymous, they tend to be people who have been problem gamblers for a long time and have had a lot of debris in their destructive life behind them, many years of it. And that Gamblers Anonymous has been shown to be helpful with preventing relapses. But not so much. It's not a one-step cure or a 12-step cure, because the statistics say that only a very low percentage of people, once they get into Gamblers Anonymous when they start, are abstinent and still in Gamblers Anonymous a year later. Mm-hmm. The vast majority of them are not.
So what do you recommend to somebody who might say, gee, my wife or my husband, spends half her paycheck on scratch tickets or lottery tickets or, heads over to the
biggest problem is a lot of people with a lot of these addictions say, no, I'm not addicted because I can stop anytime I want. And people don't realize that gambling or any kind of addiction is often a phasic behavior. You go in phases. So very few people are drunk 24/7, 365. That's just not kind of how the human organism treats its addictions. So people go hot and cold on these things. If you think someone has a screen addiction, internet addiction, gambling addiction, any kind of addiction, you have to speak to a knowledgeable professional. And there is another problem, because a lot of people don't focus and specialize in addiction treatment. The predominant methodology, as we've talked about on this show, is AA or NA, something like that. But that is not suitable for many people, especially if you're in the kind of community like Cape Cod. Pretty much know everyone at AA and NA, and they know that you have to go to a good meeting, and some meetings aren't so good, so where do you find the right meeting and the right sponsor? So if you think you have someone who is addicted, consult anyone you can who you think may have helpful information, and that starts the connect the dots process to get to someone who can help you.
Addictions don't generally stop without leverage, and what I mean by that is that there has to be a significant threat of great loss before
or incarceration.
Hitting bottom.
We have to leave it there. Psychologist Michael Abbruzzese, psychiatrist Jonathan Schwartz, and psychiatrist Mark Willey, thanks so much for being here this morning. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Happy Thanksgiving.
Oh, happy Thanksgiving to you. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.
The Point is produced by Amy Vince. The executive producer is Mindy Todd. Production assistance from Jenny Junker and Dan Tridle. Theme music by Benjamin Verdery and William Coulter.